you might hit a perfect shot from a situation that leaves you 25 feet, and then, you know, strokes gained would say that that's bad, but you're like, no, that's a perfect shot in a three situation. But I would just say, more than anything, ones, 1.5s, the basic shots you need to dominate. It needs to feel as easy as lag putting in those situations. That's kind of what I'll say.
This is The Tournament Code.
We appreciate you taking the time to join us today, Derek. Know a little bit, obviously, about you through a few different ways, one of them being social media, and we'll talk about that. But before we get going, what we like to do is Puttview Books is our sponsor. They essentially keep our lights on. Those of you can see, my lights aren't on behind me, so it means I need to put out more episodes so I can keep them on. Puttview Books sponsored us, and so as part of that, we found this useful, not just for sponsorship, but just to break the ice. We do a Puttview Books opening tee shot, which is a trivia question, puts you on the spot. If you get it wrong, no big deal. Every now and then we have a mulligan, but I think Jack has prepared a trivia question for you. So Jack Bergstrom, what do we have for him today?
So for the 2024 PGA Tour season, what player led in strokes gained around the green?
Hideki.
That is correct, which seems unfair with the guy who hits it that good and chips it that good.
Yeah, people don't realize how good he is around the green. And yeah, awesome player.
That is cool. So you, obviously, I mean, we see guys on TV, but you see them in person a decent bit. Tell us a little bit about your work coaching guys on the tour, just in general, short game. And we'll dive into some of your background later, et cetera, too.
Yeah, I teach all parts of golf in Tucson. So I teach a ton of swing. It's not, my passion is teaching golf, playing golf, tournament golf, high pressure golf. I love every ounce of it. New players, tour players, everyone. My specialty, my favorite area to teach is high level short gaming. So that's where most of the tour guys who see me work with, they'll hire me for that, which is great because a lot of them are already so good and they're missing one piece. Also, there's a lot of great swing coaches out there who I'm friends with, who I would recommend them for things. I like being in the basket I'm in because generally I'm helping a player go from sub 100th in the world to like top 20. And they're already great. They have a great living. And I help a ton of Korn Ferry guys as well. But I guess the guys currently that I'm helping are kind of trying to get to that next tier. And short game is really the area I feel like I can problem solve the best. For any player, but then tour players as well.
So when it comes to tour players, let's say a guy comes to you in that category and wants to bump up his game. To a lot of lay people, you look at most tour players' short game, like everyone's like, dang, that guy, I mean, that guy's already pretty good. Like, where can you spot, what sort of delta is there possible? Like, what sort of gains are possible? It's probably what most people think. When you have a guy come to you like that, where are you looking at for the potential gains, and what are you seeing in regards to that?
Yeah, it's, you know, if you look at where you can gain like the most strokes, right? Like, so that's like ball striking, putting potentially. If you look at like the top and bottom of short game, generally I'm trying to help someone save a couple shots a tournament. So if you look at, you know, kind of the range of, you know, Hideki, I think he's around 0.5-ish maybe per round or something like that. And then if you look at the worst, it's not this massive window like you might see in ball striking through the week. So really, a lot of times they'll come, they always reach out to me. Again, I don't reach out to anyone. Business is fine, so I don't do that. But a lot will reach out with just some opinions I have, shots they struggle with, situations they struggle with. I've helped players as I tend to have some specialties in spins, some yips I've done a lot of work with. And even these top guys, I remember one of the first guys I worked with, he had just won on the PGA Tour and we're starting to work. And I'm like, what are you thinking about here? He's like, I'm just trying to hit the green. And it was like the simplest chip. And I was like, whoa, you just won on tour and you have like those kind of demons. It's pretty interesting. So it's just kind of getting my opinion. There's so many awesome coaches and everyone has different opinions on what they think is right and wrong, or good and bad, or, you know, what can work. So I think I've allowed myself to be very open-minded to where I have a lot of answers to different questions that players might have.
So whenever you're starting to work with a player, how do you measure, you know, their improvements? Because I know that strokes gained, short game may not be, you know, the perfect gauge for that. You know, like how we were talking about Hideki, you know, he obviously is a very good short game player, but a lot of that may be due to the fact that he is such a good ball striker. He's missing a lot of shots in the right, in the correct areas. So do you use strokes gained or do you look at something else based?
There's different numbers, right? And stats have that range. And I would tend to agree. Now, Hideki particularly is interesting. If you notice his style of play, it is very aggressive. So that's what's even a little bit more impressive potentially. Now, I would still say if you look at the top 20 of strokes gained around the green, you look at the bottom 20, I don't think there's this massive potentially like, oh, this guy, you know, should be way up here. So I do understand some of that. But you can look at scrambling percentage. You can look at around the green. You can look at really the key is, and I've seen this with my last few players, there's just a clarity to where they're so confident now in what shots they can hit, where before they had maybe a little bit of confusion. They didn't know why certain things were working. So with a few of my latest players, really they're kind of down a path. They had some questions. We were able to answer those quite quickly. And now they feel like they're on the path to where they want to go. So a lot of it too can be internal with shots or situations that they've struggled with in the past that they can now hit under tournament pressure. So different ways to answer that question for sure. As there are no perfect stats, but really when stats have been poor and, you know, we see a bunch of areas start to trend, it can be pretty clear an improvement there.
When you're working with a player on their short game, do you ever work with them on kind of leaving their approach shot in a more manageable spot? Or are you just teaching just straight short game wherever it ends up, that's where we're going to end up? Are you teaching kind of a course management discipline strategy to short game as well?
Awesome point, right? Because that is a huge deal. My crew, they do a great job of up and downs. They quantify them as like a 1.5, 2 is kind of like more difficult. 3 would be kind of impossible, where probably you'd want to score a 3. So they're a great job as a player caddy combo to recognize that. And what I'm a big proponent of, and I have like that 24 ball drill, when you have these kind of easy up and downs, 1, 1.5, you need to gain strokes there. You have to be great at the simple ones. You just have to be. Because the difficult ones will be difficult for everyone. Now, we still want to be able to answer those questions and have those shots, but it is recognizing when it is okay, you know, to hit a shot that you might hit a perfect shot from a situation that leaves you 25 feet, and then, you know, strokes gained would say that that's bad, but you're like, no, that's a perfect shot in a 3 situation. But I would just say more than anything, 1s, 1.5s, the basic shots you need to dominate. It needs to feel as easy as lag putting in those situations. That's kind of what I'll say.
You mentioned that sometimes players have demons. I've been at a point even currently where I have demons having the yips, something like that, where you look at what you know. Like for me, back 10 years ago, I used to have a chip shot like that. I was like, oh, like back then I was thinking I can probably make this. I mean, this is right for the taking. Whereas now I look at it and think, man, it's sitting right off the green. I hope I can not flub it, chip it on the green, et cetera. When you have players who come to you with demons, are those issues oftentimes, do you think they're mental issues, the ones that you're diagnosing, are they mental issues? Are they like technique issues that then manifest themselves in mental scars? What do you see?
Yeah, great question. I was just on, this is always what's so interesting. I was just on Awesome Mental Guys podcast. And the challenge is knowing if something's mental or technical, and you get different answers. So I've had a lot of people, and I'm kind of like the last resort because they've been told it's mental. But in my opinion, and every yipper I've seen in person in Tucson has been able to be, you know, cured to some amount. Now again, does that mean they're going to still have anxiety? Sure. But they start to see better results, because generally what I've found, and again, this is specific to me, everyone's got different opinions. Some people say, oh, it's just mental. I've never seen it be just mental. Generally, and for you, I'm just sure you've just started to see worse and worse and worse results. So at that point, would you be confident? Also, there's times I've played in high-level events. I have terrible thoughts going through my head, but I'm so confident in the form I'm going to use. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to trust it and hit a great shot. I hit a ton of great shots. Even though maybe I'm not in the most best mental place. Now, Would I want someone to fix their form to make it seem easy to hit those shots so that now they're confident in situations and real confidence, right? There's times where you want to be able to see enough great shots to be like, oh, okay, now I should be confident, rather than, man, you know, I'll try to think more confidently here, but maybe it's a technique designed not for success that a lot of people try to overcome with high level skill. And that's generally what I've seen. I've never seen it, in my opinion, be just mental. I've never seen anyone, in my opinion, with great technique ever have the yips.
It's interesting that you say that, because I mean, I'm not a coach, but I've seen a decent number of guys that have yips and, or at least struggle heavily. And all of them, they're like, oh man, they think maybe it's mental. Pretty much all of them, similar thing. Like, there's an outstanding flaw. Now, I take all that and I can't diagnose myself very well, but I at least know that there's probably some sort of technique issue. So when you have guys that have technique issues that are giving them demons, one, I want to know kind of like what you tell them to try to get them back on track. And then number two, I also want to, after that, kind of talk about stock. Like, if you have a stock setup, stock XYZ for different types of shots, or if it varies by player.
I would also like to ask, what are some of the most common technique shortcomings with people who have the yips?
So when someone flies in, I'll generally rate them 1 to 10 on a scale of yipping. Some people come in, they think they have the yips. I'm like, oh no, you just suck. Like, you're just bad. Like, you stink. Like, we can get you better, but they ain't the yips, bro. You're just bad chipper. And then there's some people who have played, I'll rate the kind of 9s and 10s with kind of extreme spastic movements. And generally those spastic movements are somewhat needed, as I've kind of found some metrics where a lot of the yips happen with kind of these ups and downs and really kind of some late downs into the right. So that's where you kind of see these spastic movements that they've kind of cultivated over time that actually have some logic in there, but it's really non-desirable. So you can just imagine. So like an example would be, and this is kind of with one of the players I mentioned, in their golf swing, they'll have some up movement in their backswing. And then generally, you know, in short game, if I have that, well, that'll kind of pull somewhat of my club radius away from the ground. And then they'll kind of dive it back into the ground. And that can be with some elbows, that can be with some wrist action. So that's where some of those things, in my opinion, I would call them yip movements. The challenge with yips and the challenge with mental, and I do love mental stuff, but the challenge with mental that is hard to quantify is, if something's bad and someone says, oh, it's just mental, you really can't always prove them wrong, right? So it's just like, oh, it's just mental. It's like, eh, maybe. I can't prove that it's not, until you find someone who feels like they have solutions for what you're doing, to where then if you cure them in a technical way, and then they get better mentally because they're seeing better shots. So that's really the only time you can overcome that. That's the challenge with some mental game stuff. Because I've seen a few players, and I see their form. I'm like, I don't think that's helping them. And they're kind of working with some mental people to improve. And I think it's, you know, I don't interject or anything, but I would say it's probably more of a technical issue and they're trying to overcome it mentally. Whereas I would say that they have technique non-conducive to hitting good shots. They have to be in a perfect mental place to blend the skill required to hit the ball well. And I just think that their technical is not as good as it could be. And then just kind of to also sum it up, I'll tend to see people with yip movements or bad chipping where I like to quantify things as I'm either trying to hit the ball cleanly or I'm trying to use the ground. And I want both of those skills separate. And a lot of times people will blend them, and that's where they struggle. And I think an example would be, in my opinion, when Tiger was having some short game stuff, some issues, he was potentially maybe trying to use the ground, but he had some dig principles in there. And then there was times where he's trying to hit the ball clean, but he had some using the ground principles in there. And I don't really like them to mix and match. And that's where you can have things really click with players, when they understand what's required for catching the ball more cleanly and or using the ground.
I remember this summer I was watching Golf Channel, and it might have been during the US Open or just after. But they would always throw Johnson Wagner on there, and he would hit a few shots, and everybody saw that he was struggling with the chipping yips.
So good. So funny.
It was hilarious. But at some point, Akshay Bhatia had reached out to him and had said, you know, I'll give you one tip that will fix this. And he basically said, just accelerate on the way back and, you know, effectively decelerate on the way through. What would you say to that as sort of a simple fix?
Yeah, I mean, so in my opinion, Johnson's, I've seen it, and, you know, I think Joe Mayo's done some stuff on it. It's just straight technical. His technical sucks. And if you look back, it's funny because, you know, I don't know Johnson, but it's a technical issue. It could be fixed really quickly if you wanted, in my opinion. And if you just look at old Johnson chipping compared to new, you would just see technical differences. That, in my opinion, is the issue. And it's the same thing in full swing. Like, when someone's like, oh, you got quick with it, it's like, well, yeah, maybe the speed you did it didn't allow you to square up the face. But I wouldn't say, I mean, it's a technical issue, in my opinion, that could be fixed really quickly. And in my opinion, like, so it's just like too flat, too shallow. He's designed to hit the ground early with some dig principles, and that can be improved quite quickly. But everyone's got different opinions. Some would say that his form's fine, but I would just say it's a technical issue that can be fixed pretty quick. Because if you saw back in his prime, he led in short strokes gained around the green. So I would challenge anyone to show me that he has the same technique then as he does now.
When students come to you for your help, is there like a universal technique flaw amongst the people with the chipping spookies that stands out, or is it all kind of across the board?
It's different. There's somewhere when they're nines and tens, when they're extreme yippers, we can fix their technical, but then we do have to kind of work through some mental stuff too, because I'll see some people with these movements and they're like, yeah, I've been doing this for years. I'm like, how can you be seen in public doing this as long as you have? Your poor playing partners probably can't sleep at night watching you chip, because that is catastrophic. So generally it's kind of quantifying where they have some yip movements and allowing kind of to train some of the opposite skills so that they can improve. It just depends. So like those nines and tens with the yippers, they'll tend to have a lot more of this kind of up and down movements that you got to work and calm down.
When it comes to technique, is there any sort of, so let's talk about a few different types of shots and what maybe your stock is, because some coaches teach stock shots, stock ball position, etc. And let's say I'm chipping from 3 yards off the green and the pin is 7 yards on and the lie is, call it just a clean fairway lie. Nothing too tight, nothing too shaggy. What is if you just say, hey man, what's your general club of choice and then general technique or plan of choice for that?
I would have a stock for anyone kind of ball first and ground first. So I don't really have just a stock thing I like to teach, because I have some things I prefer when someone wants to hit the ball clean. I have some things I prefer when someone wants to use the ground. So in that situation, it depends on the player. Like I've got a really cool guy flying in, I think in a couple weeks, he's like 6'10 or 6'11. And he's always been told to get his feet close. So I'm like, man, you better not get your feet close, dude. I need you to feel like you're easy to hit the ground. So him, I've got some players super wide. Now, again, in a 3 yard chip, do you need a ton of movement? Do you need a lot of club head swing? No, you want to be relatively online? Yes. If we're trying to go ball first, and that's where, again, I think Joe Mayo's fantastic at really teaching how to get the ball cleanly. So generally ball first would be kind of medium, medium, low. And then ground first would be kind of medium to high, depending on the terrain. So I would have some preferences, and just to simplify, I would say that ball first would be a lot like your golf swing. So it's okay to have some shaft lean, some rotation. We're not necessarily trying to throw the shaft or anything. And then ground first, I'm trying to hit I am intentionally trying to hit the ground behind the ball with a lot of no dig principles, lining the shaft up, having, you know, using the bottom of the club, having the heel up potentially to limit surface area interaction. So those would be some things I can talk about to the player.
Let's pull that thread there on ball first and ground first principles and the net effect of them. what sort of situations are you recommend? Like, again, preference wise, are you recommending, all right, here's where I might want ball. I mean, you talked about ball flight, but here's where I might want ball first. Here's where I might want ground first. And here's the net effect, not just in trajectory, but also spin and margin for error, et cetera.
That's a great question. So that's where you're trying to see what the lie would allow for. So like, in, let's just give an example. So from Arizona and the ground's super firm and we're somewhat amount of short-sided, some amount of elevated green. Well, then at that point, I feel like I can use the ground to help me hit this ball a little bit higher with some potential spin to get it to stop quicker. So generally, if the ground's firm enough, I can use it and it's kind of short-sided, I need some stopping power. That's a little bit more of where I'll use the ground. If I need to feel like I can hit the ball cleanly and kind of let it run out some. And then that's where you got to blend what I call taking care of the lie. And this is, I think, a situation we kind of talked about before. But like, if you have a Nashville into the grain lie, and I feel like, man, I don't know if I can use this ground, I've got to somewhat catch it cleanly. And then it makes sense for me to kind of one hop it into the bank to hit it up the hill because I feel like I can get the best contact that way, where if I try to use the ground, it might dig and then I don't know. So it's taking care of the lie first within reason. And sometimes you just guess and you're wrong. Sometimes you feel like you can maybe use the ground, but then it kind of stands up. So that's just a part of it. So it's trying to figure out if you can hit the shot you want and then what that shot would look like. Because I've got some players that are really good at using the ground where some players can't. And some are more comfortable hitting the ball first and just getting those results kind of playing more along the ground. So it's a little bit of give and take there.
Can you outline how Joe Mayer teaches short game and why that's controversial, or not controversial, but contrary to what has traditionally been taught?
And with everyone kind of involved, they're all awesome teachers. I love anyone getting someone better at golf. I think what Joe has done is, and again, this is where you can, you know, look at the stats, but if you ask the player, you know, if you ask like a Victor Hovland how his short game is, I would guess he would say it's probably as good as, you know, he feels like it's been. Now, would the stats always maybe show that? You can check them out for yourself. Again, Joe's a great coach. You know, Parker's an awesome coach. They're both great people. They're nice to me. I'm kind of in the middle of all this. And I like a lot of different ways that can work. I think Joe does a great job of explaining his methods and theories very measured.
I think we should say Joe Mayo and Parker McLaughlin have had somewhat of an online feud about how the short game should be taught. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, they both have their beliefs. And they're very strong about them, which is great. You want to have a coach that believes in what they teach. Obviously, there's guys that do both styles that are very good. And I think both would agree that I don't think they're saying that the other person's wrong or that it can't happen. I think they're just standing more behind their points in kind of what they teach. So, yeah, I think they both have strong beliefs. Joe's just very measured, and likes to measure shots. I think it's fantastic. He likes tangible evidence. And again, I'm not saying that Parker doesn't by any means. Again, they're both awesome and get players better. So if you have a coach that gets players better and you like their style, that's what golf teaching is all about.
So when it comes to what we were talking about with ground first and ball first, you said that, you know, if I was looking for some more spin, I might go ground first, which seems, and can you help explain why that might give us more spin? Because some people might say, well, Maestro Mayo, his teaching is a little bit more ball first and is what it seems like. And I think you might have said that earlier. And ostensibly, you're getting 10,000. Like if you're really smoking, you might be getting 10,000 RPMs on that thing, which is insane, or at least pretty strong, depending on the type of shot. So tell us how ground first can create more spin and what that looks like.
Yeah, and I would say more stopping power, right? Because if you see, like, you know, if you've ever hit like the fun shots like Kiradech and those guys hit the tie spinner, it's got a ton of spin, but what's the launch angle? What's it launching at, right? So the 55 spin loft is a good number for kind of guaranteeing a lot of spin when the requirements are met, but the launch, you know, what Joe talks about, it's kind of that, it's a low launching, high spinning chip. So if you watch it, how quickly does it touch earth and then how quickly does it stop? Well, when you start using the ground in a lot of my spin shots, so I can launch the ball depending on the version of spinner, and I have kind of a video online, My Secrets to Spinning It, that talk about a lot of my stuff. So then I can start launching it 35 with a ton of spin. I can launch it 40 degrees with a ton of spin. I can start to launch it 50 degrees with quite a bit of spin. Those are the ones that are super fun on social media that you see me launching, where I use the ground. The ball essentially spins back from 8 to 10 yards because I'm launching it high. Is it the most amount of spin? It's not. It's kind of on the back end of the spin loft mountain. But I can stretch spin loft, and we've measured shots where, you know, spin loft being 55 degrees, you know, kind of the 45 dynamic, 10 degrees down, that's awesome. But we've measured at ping, I think my spin loft's been above 80 degrees where I can still create friction. So again, is it the most amount of spin? No. But with the combo of being able to launch it higher while still keeping friction, that's kind of the potential off the ground. And that's where I'm using the ground. And this is what we've done with Chris Como, is those ones I'm launching 50 plus is where we're hitting the ground and using the ground to where I'm hitting up 6 on the golf ball. So I'm not even hitting down. I'm using the ground to redirect and start to hit up while still getting friction. So I would say that's where we can increase stopping power, because if you do ever hit, like if you just put the ball back and chop way down on it, the spin's going to be super high and it might, you know, fly 15 yards, tons of spin. But at the launch angle, it's still going to have to check, you know, hit a few times, check, and then still roll out at that launch window.
And let's say we're at that 15 yard shot. We got 15 yards to the pin. Pin is 7 on, so it's half and half. If for you personally, as a preference, because I mean, every player has their own thing they like. But if you said, all right, here's a shot I would want to hit to have the highest likelihood of a good outcome over multiple shots, here's what I would hit. And I'll preface that to explain, like, at least back when we were kids, I can think of, you know, I wouldn't say flop shots were becoming in vogue, but that was a lot more when you're seeing things on social media, and obviously flop shots look a lot cooler. And so a lot of people prefer to, and not that this matters too much, a lot of people prefer to hit higher shots always into the green. And the old folks were saying, no, you wouldn't hit a 7-iron in this case, but you should always be hitting this low little roller. One of them, obviously, your landing area changes. So tell us kind of what your preference would be in that kind of situation for you personally, and then why your preference would be that.
A lot of the players in my section, they know kind of what I do, and they're unimpressed with how I take spin off the golf ball and I hit these super boring shots. So I always take all four of my wedges, my 60, 55 gap wedge, 50 degrees, and pitching wedge. I'm always trying to land the ball kind of 2 steps on to have it roll out to the hole. I'm very basic. That's what I like to do. I always recommend what is simplest and what feels like the least amount of work. Now, for some tour players, and a lot of them, they use a lot of 60, and they love that. Oh, cool. Like, we can kind of talk about that. But there's also beauty in removing spin for high predictability. So that's where, you know, spin can be, depending on the lie, if it's grassy, you might not be able to catch the friction you would want. So a lot of times I'm trying to eliminate spin for myself. And in that same case, then I feel like I hit a lot of terrible short game shots to inside 3 feet because I just have a good club selection. It fits what I like to do. I've always done it. So that's for me. I've just always practiced hitting those shots to where I feel like that's the best thing for me. And then statistically, I see that it works too. Because a lot of times you'll have players say, oh, you know, I really like this and I like this. And I'll say, wow, you know, it looks like you like being at the bottom of strokes gained, everything, short game, because you stink. And, you know, just in a nice way. But like, so at that point, I don't really care what you prefer if your stats are so bad. Whereas if you have better stats, it's like, oh, okay, like then that kind of holds weight. So we're always trying to measure. You know, I like everyone to have a short game that meets their statistical needs, whatever that is, right? So like for a guy like Scottie Scheffler, he just has to be like strokes gained putting 0 to win all the time. Yeah, he can afford to miss some short putts. He's just so much better tee to green. But he's kind of that outlier in that sense.
When it comes to full swing, you said, you know, short games are special, and we've asked you a lot about it, but you work across the gamut with players. When it comes to full swing. No one has a model per se, but what are your preferences for what you like to see in a player, and what are you kind of looking at when you're helping out a player? If you're crafting a player from out of clay from scratch, what would you kind of be looking for in their swing?
It's really helping a player achieve their goals. I work with a range. Again, the average person I teach swing to is probably, and I have, you know, some good juniors and all that, but like I teach a lot of 25 to 30 handicaps who just don't move well. Now, the nice thing with kind of what I've done is I've become really good friends with some incredible swing coaches like, you know, Foley, Como, Joe, Jeff Smith, Dana Dahlquist, Mark Blackburn. So they're all incredible coaches. Now, generally, and George Gankis has probably been the person that's helped me the most. I think he gets kind of the worst rap for, I've hung out with him all the time. He's more flexible than people think. He gets all these people just striping it. He uses Leo and Johnny to help people get better super fast. I mean, he's just an incredible dude. He's been so great to me throughout my career. So he's really helped me. So generally, I'm just trying to get people to move better. So often for those 25, 30 handicaps, they kind of live by these old adages of just, you know, feet down, head still. They make these unathletic movements, very armsy. So generally, I'm just trying to help people move better and be more athletic. I think that's kind of what I will help people with, because a lot of players kind of in that older handicap range have been taught the athleticism out of their golf swings. And that can also be detrimental to contact and consistency, to where if you can explain, hey, I actually want you to move more athletically, use your feet, knees, hips, torso to your advantage if you can. That's kind of where I stand. I'm pretty flexible there, though. For me, if they can do some certain things, if they get the contact they want, if they can start the ball the where they want, if they can kind of hit some shapes, I like training skills as well, because I know that holds up under tournament pressure. So there's a lot of things I have preferences of, but then if they kind of want that next level, and that's where in short game I feel like I can help out to the highest degree. In swing, I can help out to a really great degree. But if they have some questions there, I'll send them to some of these better coaches who I think have better answers than me, and or I just being a player myself, I don't want to screw anyone up. So when something looks pretty good, even in short game, I'm like, I've had some players reach out where I'm like, you know, I don't know if you should pursue that, because I think then your swing gets worse. That's my goal with everyone I've worked with too in their short game, is I'm not trying to overtake their full game to where they lose their swing, then they lose their job. I've seen some players chase short game, try to get more short gamey movements, then they lose their swing and they lose really their tour card. So you've got to be careful there. So I'm really never trying, and I think I do a good job of making sure no one gets worse when I teach them. And then if we do have a path towards improvement, I explain the process and what that would look like.
What have you learned from, you mentioned Gankis, what have you learned from him? A lot of people are familiar with him, his style, getting Scooby with it, that kind of stuff. And I've watched a lot of his stuff. I think generally speaking, it maybe is not always articulated the way that I think about it, but fundamentally speaking, a lot of it makes sense and tracks along with what a lot of your other coaches who preach a similar style or similar, who have players with similar swings do. He just talks about it a different way.
Yeah. And the thing with George is, you know, he gets a lot of these haters, but I haven't heard anyone who's coaching better players talk smack about George Gankis. Like, he develops juniors. You just saw, like, Ian Gilligan just finished top 20 at the Shriners. He gets them to smash it, like Matt Wolf. So he gets these kids just swinging super athletically, and then he's a player himself, so he knows, like, shot shape, shot patterns. So he just gets a lot of grief because he's kind of like, hey, bro, and chill and super funny, and he's always so nice to everyone. He has all these instructors that come down. He pays for all their meal. Like, no one knows. He just pays for everything. He's the greatest dude. But what's really helped me is, and why I like people to come see me in Tucson, I love getting hands-on. I love forcing movements, because people just don't inherently golf well or move well, and they need help. So when George gets someone and they need to improve, he'll have Leo and Johnny force them to do it so they get it within, like, 30 seconds rather than just, like, you know, having just like describing what someone should do. People don't know what to do, man. So like, I'm moving them. I'm kind of somewhat forcing movements. We're kind of seeing what certain things feel like because it gets them better fast. And that's, I think, what I've learned from George is you've got to just, you know, and people, you know, would want to. It's not like you just force people to do stuff they don't want to do. It's like, no, you really help them move well by getting hands on. And that's really where I think he's brilliant. And that's helped me in my coaching.
Would you say that maybe there has been an overemphasis on having a lower vertical swing plane with the popularity of George Gankus?
That one is interesting. So, and George would say the same thing. So if he gets someone that can't move well, you know, so you can be shallow if you can rotate well, right? So for his kids that smash it, they're great movers. And then conversely, and it'd be the same for short game. If you don't move well, there's certain things that tend to be a better fit for you than people that do move well or want to move a certain way. So again, for George, if you look at a lot of his people, I mean, he gets a lot of guys that reach out that he just helps kind of under the radar who know he can get people to smash it. He gets them to drive it well. Again, if you look at a lot of his player, he doesn't really teach a lot of short players. He gets them really getting everything out of it, which is very impressive. So I would say that he does a good job of explaining if someone is trying to get more shallow, like what they need to do it. And he wouldn't recommend that everyone does get shallow. He knows that there's certain fits for certain people, and he's smart enough to know why certain things work for certain players too. I think that's where he doesn't get enough credit, as well as explaining like why a Brooks Koepka swing would work, because he can tell you why it does.
That reminds me, you talking about getting players smashed. He had somebody that qualified for the U.S. Open that was swinging it like something crazy, like
yeah, Charlie Ryder is Charlie. One of these guys is like just 200 ball speed, and he's not like a huge dude. Just smashes it, awesome.
I was gonna say he's not that big, and he's hitting it, you know, past Bryson.
Yeah, I saw him at the Korn Ferry event in Colorado that he qualified for. I think he shot like 10 under, 11 under, something in the thing. So, like, his potential is just so high, right? Anyone with ball speed, and that's why George is even more relevant, is as they just kind of noted today, they're going to kind of cut back some tour cards. There's just not going to be a lot of room for short players anymore, and it's just how it is. It's just a length game. You look at Bryson and Rory playing, you know, John Rahm's long enough, Brooks is long enough. You look at these guys, and right now, you could have sub 180 ball speed with driver, but man, these kids coming up, and I teach a bunch at some of these big D1 schools, man, they're cruising at like 185. They swing at, you know, 190. Parker Ball in Gators is like 195. A couple guys I teach are 200. Like, so when they figure it out, when they get it, man, massive advantage for them.
And I don't honestly think with equipment the way it is and with instruction the way it is, I honestly don't think it's that hard to get to 180 if you're trying to do it. I don't think
there's great, you know, I'm good friends with Marty Jurtson and Sasha, who developed the Stack. It's a great program, right? There's the kids that know, just, I tell my kids, you got to get to 190. The goal is 190 ball speed now. It's just, if you want to play at the highest level, if you want some margin for error, right? Cause you can play. And I've seen a few players that, and that's kind of where I still enjoy playing every tournament, but I'm short and crooked. Like, I'm not even long and crooked. I'm behind the eight ball off the tee, and I know what it would take to get me where I want to go. And then you just see all these guys, and we've played a couple rounds with these PGA Tour players. They're at my ball speed. They're kind of like 165-ish, playing perfect golf. Every shot's at the pin, every shot's down the middle, and they can't compete because they're hitting driver four hybrid. And longer guys are hitting driver pitching wedge. And it's just over time, can you have some weeks where you're on? You can, but to build that margin of error, that major championship game, look at Xander Schauffele, right? And I think the perfect example was that par five at the end, it's cold, and he hits 3-wood off the ground, 180 ball speed, and it's cold, wet, rainy. And it's like, wow, the guy's just a horse.
That was in the British Open.
That's just what it takes nowadays to really play at that level.
So you talk about with the elite players you're coaching, we got to get to 190 ball speed. What does coaching a kid who you think has really high-end, maybe potential pro potential, high-end D1, and say they're a sophomore in high school and you wanted to get them to 190 ball speed, is your philosophy, we're going to get that ball speed up and I'll teach them golf later? And how do you teach them how to play golf once they figure out how to really bomb and gouge?
Again, there's still the art of playing golf. But if someone's like, hey, I want to play pro, you know, if you want to give it a shot, it's going to be hard coming in at a low ball speed. It just is. You got to play like perfect golf. And then now that there's so much money in the game, right? There's like outrageous amounts of money in this game. Now you're getting a lot of these guys. They're 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", 6'6". They're massive athletes who can swing it super fast. So there's a lot of these people are getting into the game, these more athletic people who have these crazy athletic movements. And that's where I would just say, you know, if you really want to go D1, because all these D1 kids on Auburn and Florida, man, they're coasting mid-180s. They can get it to 190. And there's a lot of them coming up. And they work really hard. So if you're not going to kind of match that effort, where are you going to find your advantage? So that's the challenging part. So I just recommend it. You don't have to do it. There's guys out there low 170s, mid 170s, but you really got to play great, and you're not always a great fit on all these courses that, you know, the major championships with thick rough, and you got to have speed for this and that. So that's why I just recommend it, because that's where the game's going. And then if they roll the ball back, again, that's even more of an advantage for you. So that's just where I see the game going, and I'm trying to get my players, if they really want to try to play, just on the forefront of that.
Derek, I'm one of those massive athletes. I'm somewhat joking.
Oh, you're filling up the screen, dude.
He is. You gotta see out. Basketball. In there. He can dunk a basketball and a lot of other things, but he cannot hit the ball.
I don't want to talk to you about it.
You're sneaky short. I forget who. Someone said that to someone. You're like, they're like, man, you're sneaky short. And they're like, oh, shoot, that's not good.
That's the story of my life. I'm 6'3", 200, can dunk a basketball at the age of 29, working a full-time job plus, and I can't drive the ball worth a darn. But it's not all about me. What I was thinking is, let's say I'm a massive athlete or just an athlete, and I know this is what I want to do. I know I want to, like, be able to do it. And there's the stack system out there, but kind of the way at least I see it is that, you know, being able to create that power is one thing. And then technique is also a component of it. Cause I've seen from my perspective that, like, and particularly I'm thinking of squaring up the face. Like if my face is super open at the top, 99% of the time, I have to slow it down to try to somehow square that face up. So let's say I'm like, I'm an athlete. I know I want to be able to do this, and I'm looking for an instructor. What are the things that I should be looking, like some principles that I should be thinking of my instructor should kind of be telling me? Now, it's not like the gospel here, but like just some general principles. Like, for example, I could give you an inverse of one that I would expect you would expect wouldn't be right. If my instructor saying I should have a, you know, cup drist, again, Brooks Koepka kind of has one, and Jeff Pierce does.
Yeah, no, they're more this way. They're more that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff Pierce does a good job with him, or like Webb Simpson for a while, at least had one and made it work. So like, it's something that can work, but in general, like what are the principles that I should be expecting my instructor to pass on to me?
Yeah. So a couple of things I would say, a lot of players I see get, and you see it just on the lesson tee, we see these athletes get handcuffed by their club face. So they have a super open face. It's not in their best interest to really move their body athletically because it would come in more open. So they kind of learn to stall things, and then they hit it straight and okay. And they play sub-athletic golf their whole lives. And there's these super strong dudes that do it. So the challenge though there too, so you look at a guy like John Rahm. Is John Rahm leaving swing speed on the table? Tony Finau? Absolutely. Right. So they're still like mid 180s. And I think Tony can get it, you know, way up there, but they're at the advantage of, hey, when I shorten things, I can play a high level golf. Now, for a lot of people, if you look at long drivers, what do their wrist positions tend to be at the top for long drive? What would you say? They tend to be pretty long.
Yeah. They tend to get almost into some extension.
What grip matches up with that? So then that's why they're all No, you see them all super strong grip. So it's dependent on what's needed. Like, so for me, if I wanted to try to play, and there's preferences, right? If I needed to try to get to like 190 ball speed, for me, I'd have to go strong grip, swing length out the wazoo, because I'm not huge and you know, tall and strong enough to. I would prefer to do some of these things where I'm in more control, but then that kind of keeps me short. So it's really having an instructor that can explain the pros and cons of everything you're doing and why you should do anything. And I would say that for any area of golf, you should demand good answers from your teacher, as just so often in the past, and I think this is kind of what Joe Mayo gets at, is so often in the past, they kind of give these answers that they can't quantify, and it's like, well, just kind of keep doing this, or yeah, you just kind of were off on that one. It's like, no, give me something a little bit more tangible. Like, why should I do this? Because I think this is bad. Why should I do this? Why would you want me to do anything? So I think demanding good answers, again, for me, if I had to take a golf lesson, I have an extremely short list of people that I would listen to. And just teaching golf's hard. And even, again, no one's a perfect teacher, but it's just, you want to have coaches that can really explain why you should do things very clearly to you.
Yeah, so just one quick thing I noticed in college golf is, like, I always thought we went up about practice rounds, like, complete wrong way around the greens. What's, like, your biggest pet peeve? Say you're out at a college event watching a team of five scout a golf course. Like, what are their biggest mistakes scouting a golf course around the greens?
It's interesting because a lot of the teams now, they have all these the data that kind of shows, like, where pins will be, where you should miss. I would be interested, I guess, in why you felt – go ahead and follow up. Why do you feel like you guys did it wrong? I'm just interested to hear your opinion.
We always, like, made a big deal of circling the death spot, so it almost built in this anxiety of you can't hit it there. And then the one time you actually hit it there, you're like, well, it's over. And it's like you were just kind of building this anxiety for no reason, I think.
Yes. Okay. So yeah, I would say you want to know kind of where the spots, you know, you would not prefer to be. And there's some that are just like, you know, okay, we really just can't be there. So you're trying to leave it short. So like being aware of it is the same thing. So then at that point too, it's having expectations like, hey, if you're there, dude, just make a three, like get it on the middle of the green. Like, we're not trying to really get it up and down. You know, we kind of made our mistake with that approach. We should have really tried to not be long there, and we were. But yeah, if you're only like training doomsday scenarios,
we only hit
chips, and it's like, man, now you just feel like you're like, I don't know. It's I know yeah. What you're saying. So
we
training
only practice from the doomsday bunkers.
So I would say like it's okay to do that, but man, if you're only doing that, then you're just like, man, this course is so hard, right? You're not hitting any of the shots where it's like, no. You don't want to be there, but we don't have to give ourselves the hardest 18 up and downs. That's fun to do in you know, some contests, but I can see where that would have a negative effect, yes.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to join us. The last question we ask our guests is the same for everybody. We find it pretty insightful. If you could go, and for you, it's going to be a two-parter. If you could go back to yourself as a junior golfer and ask yourself tell yourself just one thing, what would that one thing be? And then the second part of that is, if you could tell a junior golfer just one thing, what would that one thing be?
When you're doing something well, you would love to know why you're doing it well. So like, if anything's ever good, you'd love to know why. So like, so for me, it wasn't really when I was a junior, because I was good, but it was kind of when I got to my prime of my ball striking, I wish I would have known more why it was so good and how I can stay on that track. Because then you just kind of lose things. And I just assumed I was going to always hit again, and that's not the case. And I would love to know and kind of been a little bit more measured in why it was going well. You just assume it's going to – then you lose it. And it's like, oh, shoot, I wish I would have kind of had some baseline references there. The challenge for juniors, and I see it all the time, it just depends on, like, you know, sometimes they feel so much pressure because they want to go D1. Sometimes they feel this family pressure. They start hating the game. I would always recommend for anyone, I guess you could say, just keeping the game fun. And I love playing tournament golf. I love golf. It's my favorite thing. But I also enjoy not playing golf at times when I don't want to. Like, I don't want it to be a task or a chore. And I do see, and there's some value in working hard. But if it becomes too strenuous and it feels like a job and you're a kid and the parents are pushing it, that's where I can see them just not liking the game, not liking their parents. And it's kind of this this weird thing. So I a lot of the kids too that I know will do well are the kids who don't solely focus on golf. So I've got a few players, they play a lot of different sports, and I'm like, they're going to do well. And then if you only focus on golf, that can be challenged because you're kind of putting all your eggs in one basket. You're not building other outside hand-eye coordination skills that can be helpful. So I guess those would be my best answers.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate it. Where can people find you on social media? Where can they find your website, any short game courses or coaching tools you have for them?
Yep. So my website, www.golfbettertucson.com. That's where I recommend people contact me if they want to set anything up. My most used social media platform is Instagram, just GolfBetterTucson on there. But I'm kind of all over the place. But those would be the top two I would recommend.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you joining us. For those of you listening, if you're trying to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at The Tournament Code and on Twitter at Tournament Code. If you're listening to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, like and subscribe. If you're listening on YouTube, leave a rating. We appreciate you joining us and look forward to diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.